There are famous real-life addresses that most of us know, like 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but there's also a fictional one that I bet you also know, 221B Baker Street. Walk up the 17 steps with us now as we visit the many iterations of a certain consulting detective and his Boswell. It's time to talk about the world of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. John H. Watson, and the women who understand them. Meet the Baker Street Babes. It's all new and all blue, just like a carbuncle. Next. Hey, Nolan, I bet you didn't know that I'm a Sherlockian.
I was not aware of that.
As in, I love and am fascinated by all things having to do with the great detective and his biographer, Dr. John H. Watson. You know, it amazes me that in over 100 years after these two were prowling the foggy streets of London, we still have them pervading pop culture with Sherlock on PBS, Elementary on CBS, and, of course, the movies with that Iron Man guy. One of my favorite ways to connect with the world of all things Sherlock is with the Baker Street Babes on Twitter. They're amazing, and we're lucky to have two of them to talk to, as well as a professor who specializes in Sherlock Holmes studies that you interviewed, Nolan.
Yeah, Carlina Delacova. It was a great conversation.
She's a forensic anthropology professor, and that's just fascinating. So I really look forward to your conversation with her. So let's start there with Nolan's talk with Dr. Carlina Delacova.
Carlina Delacova, thanks so much for being on Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So you are a professor of anthropology at the University of South Carolina. Could you start by briefly telling us about your specialization areas?
So I'm a skeletal biologist. That's a big fancy word for basically what I do is, if you watch the show Bones, like forensic anthropology, that's what I do. I study the human skeleton and I'm able to identify individuals based on their skeletal features, kind of like Bones can. But I also study health and disease in the human skeleton. And when I'm not doing a research agenda, which is all the time, I also help law enforcement identify human skeletons like the show Bones.
And how and when did you first become interested in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories and Sherlock Holmes?
When I was a child, I believe I was in the sixth or seventh grade, the Speckled Band was actually one of the stories that we had to read in our little book that we got in grade school. And so that was the first time that I was exposed to the actual literature itself. I'd been exposed to Sherlock Holmes through film and TV medium, Jeremy Brett and Basil Rathbone, for example. And so that was the first time I was actually exposed to the stories, and I really liked it. And I remember our teacher sort of bought in the Jeremy Brett series and made us watch the Speckled Band, that episode, that medium. So that's when I found my love of Sherlock Holmes, and I really started to read Sherlock Holmes profusely. And I came back to it again when I was a teenager, around the age of, I think, 15 and 16. And since that time, I've really been a dedicated Sherlockian.
Well, one of the staples of Holmes, the reasoner, is his use of deductive reasoning. Is that actually true? And what exactly does it mean to deduce something?
So when you deduce something, and there's been some argument in the literature as to whether or not it's inductive versus deductive reasoning. But in Holmes's case, you know, when Holmes deduces something, basically he's taking the data that he has in front of him. So the data that he can see, like literally, whether it be at a crime scene on an individual, he's drawing and observing these small details. And while he's observing these small details, he's sort of running these hypotheses. It's almost like the scientific method, right? You make observations, you draw those hypotheses, and then you state what you see based sort of on those details that you're observing. So in his case, if someone walks into his sitting room, he's able to look at them and he can tell by their hands from their handshake and he can tell by the way that they're dressed whether or not there's minuscule bits of mud splashed on their sleeves or on their shoes, how their shoes are shined, whether or not they're wearing a Masonic ring, all those sorts of things. He pulls all those together sort of to get an idea of where the individual came from, what their social position is, what sort of issues they may have encountered on the way over. So it's sort of how it works, if that makes sense. It's pulling together a number of details observed to make a deduction about something while simultaneously like running these hypotheses in your head. I mean, Holmes was a genius in that respect.
Well, some people think that the character of Sherlock Holmes is actually the beginning of forensic science. And I'm wondering if, like so many other things, if the author was ahead of his times or was he being influenced by them? Were there police detectives starting to use these methodologies around that time in the late 19th century?
Yes, that's a very good question. In fact, the stories are sort of coinciding with what we see as the rise of forensic science. And one of the things I think I should point out is that today you can't open any forensic science academic journal, so the Journal of Forensic Chemistry, the Journal of Forensic Sciences itself, without sometime in that journal's history mentioning Sherlock Holmes or having an article that's dedicated to Sherlock Holmes. And so with the stories, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is writing the stories as these methods are being developed and as these methods are sort of coming into their own being, coming into their forte, if you will. For example, in the stories, fingerprint evidence is used a lot. And this is actually quite interesting because fingerprint evidence by itself didn't sort of become the standard for forensic science until the late 19th to very early 20th century. Prior to that, in the 19th century and the late 19th century, when we see the start of the stories, the Bertillon method was used, which was based on the body measurements, 11 body measurements, which produced a unique equation for an individual. So in that respect, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a bit ahead of his time. And James O'Brien has pointed this out in his The Scientific Sherlock Holmes, that he sort of knew the scientific importance of fingerprinting and how they would sort of hold up beyond, I guess, the Bertillon method, which is based on body measurements. But other methods would come about as the stories were being written. So you have the development of, for example, you have Edmond Locard, who's working on creating the first forensic science laboratory in Lyon, France, and he, you know, goes online and live with that in 1910. And we already have a rich history of Sherlock Holmes stories and literature being written prior to that. And it's believed that Locard actually read Holmes and he was inspired by Holmes. So there's a number of overlaps in terms of forensic science and Sherlock Holmes. So, and there's no doubt that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would have sort of been in the middle of this in the sense that, you know, he was a doctor, he was a physician, he also worked in the forensic capacity as well. So he would have had to been on top of these new cutting edge methods that were being developed. But one of the things I'll say that's interesting about the canon is that we don't see a lot of photographic evidence, and photography started to be used as a medium in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it's not mentioned a lot in the stories, which has kind of puzzled me. I know Laurie R. King and her take on Sherlock Holmes with Mary Russell, she uses it, but it's not really used that much in the actual canon itself. But dogs are. And the use of dogs for tracking things is, and other things that we would later sort of use and bring into fruition. So I would say that, yes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was sort of on the cutting edge in that respect, and that a lot of forensic folks today also take inspiration from the canon. We sort of come full circle with it, if that makes sense.
What's an example of a story from the canon that stands out to you as an example of scientific reasoning?
Oh, goodness, there are so many that sort of bring scientific reasoning and forensic science into fruition. And one of my favorites has always been in terms of forensic science itself and how we go about investigating crime scenes and pulling inferences has been The Hound of the Baskervilles. It's not only one of my favorite stories, but it really stands out in that respect, not only because you have, you know, foot impression and shoe impression evidence. You have the use of document analysis, which is something, I mean, we should really keep in mind. Holmes was doing document analysis in the late 19th and early 20th century. The FBI didn't establish their document analysis lab until 1932. right? So it's got document analysis. It's got anthropological analysis. It's got trace evidence in it. Everything from cigar ash to phosphorus. I don't want to give any spoilers for any of the listeners out there that haven't read the story yet. So it's just rich in all these things, and profiling an individual and going undercover and using undercover methodology. And of course, it's one of the longer stories because it's a novella. But I think it stands as one of the richer ones. Some would say The Sign of Four as well, but my favorite will always be The Hound of the Baskervilles.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that modern audiences might have about Sherlock Holmes as a criminologist?
As a criminologist, I thought you were going to ask as a person, because if you asked as a person, I would have said that he's sexist and a misogynist, and that's not the case. I don't know in terms of as a criminologist. That's a really good question. To date, I haven't heard any, at least in my own circles and teaching my students about Sherlock Holmes, I haven't heard any real misconceptions about his ability as a criminologist so much as a person. And that, you know, he is a misogynist, which he isn't, in my opinion, because of the way that he treats women. And he's very impressed by women that are very strongly independent and have their own sense of agency. And that he's a bit like the Benedict Cumberbatch version of Sherlock Holmes, which he was not. So, but in terms of his criminology aspect, I can't think of any misconceptions off the top of my head about him.
So is it just in the interpretation by Benedict Cumberbatch that kind of created that misconception of him as a person?
I wouldn't say that. No, there's been sort of in the literature for years, there's been murmurings about Holmes being a sexist or Holmes being a misogynist, or with the case of Benedict Cumberbatch, Holmes sort of being this someone who may suffer from Asperger's. And I don't buy into that, but as I'm sure you've heard, there's arguments within the sort of fandom and within Sherlockiana about that, especially the Asperger's syndrome bit. But I don't know where this idea of Sherlock Holmes being a misogynist came from. But I mean, I know he said things about women that, you know, if you, you know, women get entirely too emotional at times, women aren't to be trusted, not the best of them. Women can be easily frazzled. They get their bell wires tripped really easily. Yet when Holmes engages with women, he doesn't treat them as these delicate, dainty things that are going to shatter at all. He treats them as these women that are very, you know, empowered. And even in the story, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is writing these very strongly independent, highly intelligent women that, you know, want to have their own sense of agency in their outcomes. And Irene Adler, for example, is, you know, one of the gutsiest women I know that's been written at the time period, next to the women in Jane Austen's novels. So I don't honestly know where these sort of misconceptions came from, because they're not in the film literature as well, at least about women. The Asperger sense, the rudeness that you see in the Cumberbatch version, that's not the interpretation that I take away from Sherlock Holmes at all. I think Sherlock Holmes, he was highly intelligent, but he knew how to interact and function with people. He could be rude in the sense that, you know, he did like to boom himself. He did have a little bit of an ego, but he also had a wicked sense of humor. And I think when we look at our interpretations of Sherlock Holmes, that's sort of forgotten. And he had a playfulness, and that playfulness and that sense of humor, I think it's captured brilliantly by Peter Cushing's BBC Sherlock Holmes show, and a little bit by the RDJ, the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes.
Well, speaking of the more recent interpretations of the character, what do you think about, you know, the differences between the CBS series Elementary and the BBC's Sherlock?
You know, there's always this pitting the two against each other, especially when Elementary came out. I think Elementary, it's true investigation, right? It's a typical police procedural, right? And I like the idea of a female Watson. I embrace that. I like Lucy Liu as Watson. I like Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes. I think each actor that plays Sherlock Holmes brings their own sort of uniqueness to the character. And that's what Johnny Lee Miller has done. That's what Benedict Cumberbatch has done. But I like the idea of Sherlock Holmes, you know, going out and solving crimes, interacting with the police force, being sort of the way Sherlock Holmes is a little bit more in the novels. And then there's this emphasis as well on drug addiction, which the BBC, you know, Sherlock has sort of brought to the forefront in its last season, especially, which I won't give spoilers for folks who haven't seen it. But so I think it's two different approaches. And for me, it's not who is better or who is worse or what do. I think it's a matter of what these particular actors bring to the plate as Sherlock Holmes. Because as a true Sherlockian, for me, it's all about embracing the different interpretations of Sherlock Holmes and inspiring, you know, future generations to sort of engage with this unique character, this literary character that still lives, that hasn't died, that people see as this living, breathing entity.
In your own work as an anthropologist, does the character resonate with you? And if so, how?
Oh, definitely. For me, there isn't a day that passes that I don't use Holmes's methods of observation and his sense of justice, and especially for me, not only justice when I'm working as a deputy coroner, but doing forensic work, but also justice in the form of social justice in the individuals that I study. I study individuals that were dissected in the late 19th and early 20th century, and they were dissected without consent. The laws of the states and districts in which they lived in indicated that if you were an individual, an impoverished individual, and you received your health care at charity clinics and charity hospitals that were funded by the taxpayer, as well as mental institutions, if no one claimed your body within, I think it was 32 to 78 hours, then your body was sent to the state anatomical board, which then sent it to universities for anatomical dissection and study. And so for me, studying the lives of those individuals and looking at the relationship between sort of their poverty and their circumstances and how that impacted their health and, you know, evidence of trauma and fractures on their skeleton. For me, that's invoking Holmes and his sense of bringing about justice. So there isn't a day methodologically that I don't use Holmes's methods of keen observation to pull together a story, to observe what I see in the skeleton, to observe what I see in the historical data of these individuals, to observe what I see, you know, in a crime site or the artifacts associated with the individuals that, you know, I study, and sort of create a picture. So Holmes is very much a part of what I do. And I've often said that I see Holmes as an anthropologist, and I'm not the first one to say that. Many of the founding fathers of my discipline, well, I shouldn't say the founding fathers, but the scholars in the 1940s, there was one in particular who wrote an article on Sherlock Holmes, the anthropologist, and how he studied human behavior and how he studied people and how he studied crime. Why did he keep bees? What was the purpose of him keeping bees in retirement? I mean, yeah, it's entomology, it's science, but I've always argued that maybe he kept bees to get at human behavior and understand human behavior, because bees have, you know, complex forms of communication, complex society, that sort of thing.
Dr. Carlina Delacova, thanks so much for being on Blue Dot.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our special about the Baker Street Babes in the world of Sherlock Holmes. And we'll be talking to Ashley Polasek about the role of Sherlock in the original stories. We'll be right back. And we're back on Blue Dot on North State Public Radio, talking next with Ashley Polasek. She's got a PhD in adaptations of Sherlock Holmes in film and literature. And how did you first encounter the characters of Sherlock Holmes and John H. Watson?
I was underneath a duvet in a small room in Scotland. I had a friend who recommended the stories to me. I was studying abroad at the University of St. Andrews, and a friend recommended the stories to me. I went to a little used bookstore and bought the complete canon for, I think, £3. And I read a couple stories a night by flashlight, believe it or not, under my duvet. And by the time I came back stateside, I was thoroughly hooked.
And of course, you're one of the Baker Street babes. And
yes.
Before we go any further, could you explain to us the genesis of that group?
Well, I have to say that I have not been a member of the group since its very first days. I was brought in. I think it had already been going on for maybe a year and a half to 2 years, but it's primarily a podcasting group that has since branched out into other areas. We run events and various. We have a large social media presence. We do some publishing and that sort of thing. But it started out really as just a group of young women who all loved Sherlock Holmes and wanted to talk about it and didn't have anywhere else or anybody else to do it with. And it kind of grew from there.
How could you explain to our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the original stories? They know Sherlock Holmes from television and screen adaptations, but not really the original stories. But how would you recommend that to a person?
I think the first thing to say is that they're much more contemporary, much more modern than you think they are. In your mind, we sometimes tend to think of like the written text as living in black and white. And actually, they're very contemporary feeling adventure stories. They're not a lot of people sitting in armchairs just pondering things. They don't plod along. There's a lot of action in them, and the characters are interesting and you can follow along. And on top of that, particularly the short stories are so splendidly crafted and bite-sized that you can really just sit and enjoy one in one sitting, and it's fun and it's self-contained, and you can read them at your own pace and enjoy them, and they bear rereading really well. You can go back and re-enjoy the same story even after you know the mystery, because the characters are so compelling and the dialogue is so accessible. And the stories are just interesting enough to keep going back to over and over again.
Is there a particular story that you would suggest for someone to read first to expose themselves to Doyle's
I think
world?
The best thing to do, now Arthur Conan Doyle originally wrote two shorter novels before he settled on serialized short stories as the primary mode for Sherlock Holmes. I would skip over the two novels, that is A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four, and go straight to the very beginnings of the short stories. They start with A Scandal in Bohemia, and you can pick up The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which is a collection of the first, I believe, 13 stories, and that's a great place to start.
And A Scandal in Bohemia, of course, has one of the great female characters in all of the canon. Can you tell us a bit about her?
The character is Irene Adler. And the genius of Irene Adler is that Conan Doyle decided that the very first short story, which was going to be the first introduction to Sherlock Holmes for most readers, really, who hadn't read the novels, he was going to face a nemesis who was really not a villain, but who got the best of him and made her a woman, first of all, which is pretty remarkable. And second of all, you see in the very first story that Holmes is fallible. He gets outsmarted by this very clever, very poised woman who's described as an adventuress, which is a kind of 19th century euphemism for a worldly woman who used her sexual charms to gain position and power. So she's a fascinating character. She turns up in a lot of adaptations when they're looking for some kind of equal for Sherlock Holmes, or potentially as a romantic interest, though there's not really, that's not in the story, but people like to read into that.
When we talk about the original stories, it's interesting to me to think about what's the origin of these characters, because they're so iconic now. What have we had, like over 200 movies based on Holmes and Watson, numerous television adaptations, So many great actors have played them. But what was the source material? Where did these characters actually come from? Do we know?
Well, Conan Doyle did not set out to be a writer. He was a trained medical man, and he went to set up his private practice in Portsmouth in Southsea, and didn't really have a very good practice. In fact, he went on to study as an eye doctor briefly in Vienna, and he came back and he writes in his autobiography that he did not see a single patient when he opened his door and laid out his shingle as an eye doctor. And he was kind of bored and wanted something to do, so he began writing these stories. He really was frustrated at the state of detective fiction because it always seemed that the detective kind of magically knew the answer, and he wanted to impose a sense of order so that the reader could potentially find the solution for themselves if they were paying close enough attention. He didn't want the detective fiction genre to be sort of trickery. He based the Holmes character loosely on his mentor at the University of Edinburgh, Joseph Bell, who really did kind of miraculous diagnostics. So a patient would walk in and he would be able to say, based on things like, their fingernails or their shirt cuffs or the knees of their trousers, what occupations they had or where they'd come from, what they'd done that day. And so he Conan Doyle used those characteristics in forming the Sherlock Holmes character. Arguably, the Watson character is kind of Conan Doyle a little bit, but he's really more us because the stories are told in first person by Watson, and he's kind of the observer of Holmes. And so he's our entry into the story. He's really us.
And when you talk about the Joseph Bell being perhaps one of the, probably one of the inspirations, you know, we're really talking about the scientific method here of, you know, Holmes makes these observations and then he thinks about it and cogitates over them and then develops a hypothesis and tends to test them. So really, in a large way, it's the beginnings of forensic science.
It is. Well, there are a lot of forensic techniques that are in the stories that weren't really used as forensic techniques at the time. He was on kind of the cutting edge of a lot of things, tracking footprints and tire tracks, blood spatter analysis, fingerprint analysis. These are things that were really in their infancy as far as crime detection was concerned. And they found their way into the story. So Holmes is certainly the founding father of a lot of forensics.
Thanks to our guests today, the Baker Street Babes and Dr. Carlina Della Cova. We're going to be continuing our look at the world of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John H. Watson in pop culture next week when we talk some more with Ashley Polasek and Amy Thomas, two of the Baker Street Babes. You can link to their website and Twitter and Facebook accounts at mynspr.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio and engineered by Professor Moriarty, a.k.a. Nolan Ford. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews and me at Dave Schlum. The evil mathematician and I both remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.